My first conviction, as soon as I found myself outside the house, was that no alternative was left me but to act at once on the information I had received, to make sure of the count that night, or to risk the loss if I only delayed till the morning of Laura's last chance. I looked at my watch. It was 10 o'clock. Not the shadow of a doubt crossed my mind of the purpose for which the Count had left the theatre. His escape from us that evening was beyond all question the preliminary only to his escape from London. The mark of the Brotherhood was on his arm. I felt as certain of it as if he had shown me the brand, and the betrayal of the Brotherhood was on his conscience. I had seen it in his recognition of Pesca. It was easy to understand why that recognition had not been mutual. A man of the Count's character would never risk the terrible consequences of turning spy without looking to his personal security quite as carefully as he looked to his golden reward. The shaven face which I had pointed out at the opera might have been covered by a beard in Pesca's time. His dark brown hair might be a wig. His name was evidently a false one. The accident of time might have helped him as well. His immense corpulence might have come with his later years. There was every reason why Pesca should not have known him again, every reason also why he should have known Pesca, whose singular personal appearance made a marked man of him, go where he might. I have said that I felt certain of the purpose in the Count's mind when he escaped us at the theatre. How could I doubt it when I saw with my own eyes that he believed himself, in spite of the change in his appearance, to have been recognized by Pesca and to be therefore in danger of his life? If I could get speech of him that night, if I could show him that I too knew of the mortal peril in which he stood, what result would follow? Plainly this. One of us must be master of the situation. One of us must inevitably be at the mercy of the other. I owed it to myself to consider the chances against me before I confronted them. I owed it to my wife to do all that lay in my power to lessen the risk. The chances against me wanted no reckoning up. They were all merged in one. If the Count discovered, by my own avowal, that the direct way to his safety lay through my life, he was probably the last man in existence who would shrink from throwing me off my guard and taking that way when he had me alone within his reach. The only means of defense against him on which I could at all rely to lessen the risk presented themselves after a little careful thinking clearly enough. Before I made any personal acknowledgement of my discovery in his presence, I must place the discovery itself where it would be ready for instant use against him, and safe from any attempt at suppression on his part. If I laid the mine under his feet before I approached him, and if I left instructions with a third person to fire it on the expiration of a certain time, unless directions to the contrary were previously received under my own hand or from my own lips, in that event, the Count's security was absolutely dependent upon mine, and I might hold the vantage ground over him securely, even in his own house. This idea occurred to me when I was close to the new lodgings which we had taken on returning from the seaside. I went in without disturbing anyone by the help of my key. A light was in the hall, and I stole up with it to my workroom to make my preparations, and absolutely to commit myself to an interview with the Count before either Laura or Marion could have the slightest suspicion of what I intended to do. A letter addressed to Pesca represented the surest measure of precaution which it was now possible for me to take. I wrote as follows. The man whom I pointed out to you at the opera is a member of the Brotherhood and has been false to his trust. Put both these assertions to the test instantly. You know the name he goes by in England. His address is No. 5 Forest Road, St. John's Wood. On the love you once bore me, use the power entrusted to you, without mercy and without delay, against that man. I have risked all and lost all, and the forfeit of my failure has been paid with my life. I signed and dated these lines, enclosed them in an envelope and sealed it up. On the outside, I wrote this direction. Keep the enclosure unopened until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. If you do not hear from me or see me before that time, break the seal when the clock strikes and read the contents. I added my initials, and protected the whole by enclosing it in a second sealed envelope addressed to Pesca at his lodgings. Nothing remained to be done after this but to find the means of sending my letter to its destination immediately. I should then have accomplished all that lay in my power. If anything happened to me in the Count's house, I had now provided for his answering it with his life. That the means of preventing his escape under any circumstances whatever were at Pesca's disposal if he chose to exert them, I did not for an instant doubt. The extraordinary anxiety which he had expressed to remain unenlightened as to the Count's identity, or in other words to be left uncertain enough about facts to justify him to his own conscience in remaining passive, betrayed plainly that the means of exercising the terrible justice of the Brotherhood were ready to his hand, although, as a naturally humane man, he had shrunk from plainly saying as much in my presence. The deadly certainty with which the vengeance of foreign political societies can hunt down a traitor to the cause, hide himself where he may, had been too often exemplified, even in my superficial experience, to allow of any doubt. Considering the subject only as a reader of newspapers, cases recurred to my memory both in London and in Paris, of foreigners found stabbed in the streets, whose assassins could never be traced, of bodies and parts of bodies thrown into the Thames and the Seine by hands that could never be discovered, of deaths by secret violence which could only be accounted for in one way. I have disguised nothing relating to myself in these pages, and I do not disguise here that I believed I had written Count Fosco's death warrant, if the fatal emergency happened which authorized Pesca to open my enclosure. I left my room to go down to the ground floor of the house and speak to the landlord about finding me a messenger. He happened to be ascending the stairs at the time, and we met on the landing. His son, a quick lad, was the messenger he proposed to me on hearing what I wanted. We had the boy upstairs, and I gave him his directions. He was to take the letter in a cab, to put it into Professor Pesca's own hands, and to bring me back a line of acknowledgement from that gentleman, returning in the cab and keeping it at the door for my use. It was then nearly 10:30. I calculated that the boy might be back in 20 minutes, and that I might drive to St. John's Wood on his return in 20 minutes more. When the lad had departed on his errand, I returned to my own room for a little while to put certain papers in order, so that they might be easily found, in case of the worst. The key of the old-fashioned bureau in which the papers were kept I sealed up and left it on my table, with Marian's name written on the outside of the little packet. This done, I went downstairs to the sitting-room, in which I expected to find Laura and Marian awaiting my return from the opera. I felt my hand trembling for the first time when I laid it on the lock of the door. No one was in the room but Marian. She was reading, and she looked at her watch in surprise when I came in. "How early you are back," she said. "You must have come away before the opera was over." "Yes," I replied. "Neither Pesca nor I waited for the end. Where is Laura?" "She had one of her bad headaches this evening, and I advised her to go to bed when we had done tea." I left the room again on the pretext of wishing to see whether Laura was asleep. Marian's quick eyes were beginning to look inquiringly at my face. Marian's quick instinct was beginning to discover that I had something weighing on my mind. When I entered the bedchamber and softly approached the bedside by the dim flicker of the night lamp, my wife was asleep. We had not been married quite a month yet. If my heart was heavy, if my resolution for a moment faltered again when I looked at her face turned faithfully to my pillow in her sleep, when I saw her hand resting open on the coverlid as if it was waiting unconsciously for mine, surely there was some excuse for me. I only allowed myself a few minutes to kneel down at the bedside and to look close at her, so close that her breath as it came and went fluttered on my face. I only touched her hand and her cheek with my lips at parting. She stirred in her sleep and murmured my name, but without waking. I lingered for an instant at the door to look at her again. "God bless and keep you, my darling," I whispered, and left her. Marian was at the stairhead waiting for me. She had a folded slip of paper in her hand. "The landlord's son has brought this for you," she said. "He has got a cab at the door. He says you ordered him to keep it at your disposal. Quite right, Marion. I want the cab. I'm going out again. I descended the stairs as I spoke and looked into the sitting room to read the slip of paper by the light on the table. It contained these two sentences in Pesca's handwriting. Your letter is received. If I don't see you before the time you mention, I will break the seal when the clock strikes. I placed the paper in my pocketbook and made for the door. Marion met me on the threshold and pushed me back into the room where the candlelight fell full on my face. She held me by both hands and her eyes fastened searchingly on mine. I see, she said in a low, eager whisper. You are trying the last chance tonight. Yes. The last chance and the best, I whispered back. Not alone. Oh, Walter, for God's sake, not alone. Let me go with you. Don't refuse me because I am only a woman. I must go. I will go. I'll wait outside in the cab. It was my turn now to hold her. She tried to break away from me and get down first to the door. If you want to help me, I said, stop here and sleep in my wife's room tonight. Only let me go away with my mind easy about Laura, and I answer for everything else. Come, Marion, give me a kiss and show that you have the courage to wait till I come back. I dared not allow her time to say a word more. She tried to hold me again. I unclasped her hands and was out of the room in a moment. The boy below heard me on the stairs and opened the hall door. I jumped into the cab before the driver could get off the box. Forest Road, St. John's Wood, I called to him through the front window. Double fare if you get there in a quarter of an hour. Oh, do it, sir. I looked at my watch. 11 o'clock. Not a minute to lose. The rapid motion of the cab, the sense that every instant now was bringing me nearer to the Count, the conviction that I was embarked at last without let or hindrance on my hazardous enterprise, heated me into such a fever of excitement that I shouted to the man to go faster and faster. As we left the streets and crossed St. John's Wood Road, my impatience so completely overpowered me that I stood up in the cab and stretched my head out of the window to see the end of the journey before we reached it. Just as a church clock in the distance struck the quarter past, we turned into the Forest Road. I stopped the driver a little way from the Count's house, paid and dismissed him, and walked on to the door. As I approached the garden gate, I saw another person advancing towards it also, from the direction opposite to mine. We met under the gas lamp in the road and looked at each other. I instantly recognized the light-haired foreigner with a scar on his cheek, and I thought he recognized me. He said nothing, and instead of stopping at the house as I did, he slowly walked on. Was he in the Forest Road by accident? Or had he followed the Count home from the opera? I did not pursue those questions. After waiting a little till the foreigner had slowly passed out of sight, I rang the gate bell. It was then 11:20, late enough to make it quite easy for the Count to get rid of me by the excuse that he was in bed. The only way of providing against this contingency was to send in my name without asking any preliminary questions, and to let him know at the same time that I had a serious motive for wishing to see him at that late hour. Accordingly, while I was waiting, I took out my card and wrote under my name, On Important Business. The maidservant answered the door while I was writing the last word in pencil and asked me distrustfully what I pleased to want. Be so good as to take that to your master, I replied, giving her the card. I saw by the girl's hesitation of manner that if I had asked for the Count in the first instance, she would only have followed her instructions by telling me he was not at home. She was staggered by the confidence with which I gave her the card. After staring at me in great perturbation, she went back into the house with my message, closing the door and leaving me to wait in the garden. In a minute or so she reappeared, her master's compliments, and would I be so obliging as to say what my business was? Take my compliments back, I replied, and say that the business cannot be mentioned to anyone but your master. She left me again returned, and this time asked me to walk in. I followed her at once. In another moment, I was inside the Count's house. There was no lamp in the hall, but by the dim light of the kitchen candle which the girl had brought upstairs with her, I saw an elderly lady steal noiselessly out of a back room on the ground floor. She cast one viperish look at me as I entered the hall, but said nothing, and went slowly upstairs without returning my bow. My familiarity with Marian's journal sufficiently assured me that the elderly lady was Madame Fosco. The servant led me to the room which the Countess had just left. I entered it and found myself face to face with the Count. He was still in his evening dress, except his coat, which he had thrown across a chair. His shirt sleeves were turned up at the wrists, but no higher. A carpet bag was on one side of him, and a box on the other. Books, papers, and articles of wearing apparel were scattered about the room. On a table at one side of the door stood the cage, so well known to me by description, which contained his white mice. The canaries and the cockatoo were probably in some other room. He was seated before the box, packing it, when I went in, and rose with some papers in his hand to receive me. His face still betrayed plain traces of the shock that had overwhelmed him at the opera. His fat cheeks hung loose. His cold grey eyes were furtively vigilant. His voice, look, and manner were all sharply suspicious alike, as he advanced a step to meet me, and requested with distant civility that I should take a chair.
"You come here on business, sir," he said. "I am at a loss to know what that business can possibly be."
The unconcealed curiosity with which he looked hard in my face while he spoke convinced me that I had passed unnoticed by him at the opera. He had seen Pesca first, and from that moment till he left the theatre, he had evidently seen nothing else. My name would necessarily suggest to him that I had not come into his house with other than a hostile purpose towards himself, but he appeared to be utterly ignorant thus far of the real nature of my errand. "I am fortunate in finding you here tonight," I said. "You seem to be on the point of taking a journey."
"Is your business connected with my journey?"
"In some degree."
"In what degree?" "Do you know where I am going to?"
"No. I only know why you are leaving London." He slipped by me with the quickness of thought, locked the door of the room, and put the key in his pocket.
"You and I, Mr. Hartwright, are excellently well acquainted with one another by reputation," he said. "Did it by any chance occur to you when you came to this house that I was not the sort of man you could trifle with?"
"It did occur to me," I replied, "and I have not come to trifle with you. I am here on a matter of life and death, and if that door, which you have locked, was open at this moment, nothing you could say or do would induce me to pass through it." I walked farther into the room and stood opposite to him, on the rug before the fireplace. He drew a chair in front of the door and sat down on it with his left arm resting on the table. The cage with the white mice was close to him, and the little creatures scampered out of their sleeping place as his heavy arm shook the table and peered at him through the gaps in the smartly painted wires.
"On a matter of life and death," he repeated to himself. "Those words are more serious, perhaps, than you think. What do you mean?"
"What I say." The perspiration broke out thickly on his broad forehead. His left hand stole over the edge of the table. There was a drawer in it with a lock, and the key was in the lock. His finger and thumb closed over the key, but did not turn it.
"So you know why I am leaving London," he went on. "Tell me the reason, if you please."
He turned the key and unlocked the drawer as he spoke. "I can do better than that," I replied. "I can show you the reason, if you like."
"How can you show it?"
"You have got your coat off," I said. "Roll up the shirt sleeve on your left arm, and you will see it there." The same livid, leaden change passed over his face which I had seen pass over it at the theatre. The deadly glitter in his eyes shone steady and straight into mine. He said nothing, but his left hand slowly opened the table drawer and softly slipped into it. The harsh, grating noise of something heavy that he was moving, unseen to me, sounded for a moment,
then ceased.
The silence that followed was so intense that the faint ticking nibble of the white mice at their wires was distinctly audible where I stood. My life hung by a thread, and I knew it. At that final moment, I thought with his mind, I felt with his fingers. I was as certain as if I had seen it of what he kept hidden from me in the drawer. "Wait a little," I said. "You have got the door locked. You see I don't move. You see my hands are empty. Wait a little. I have something more to say."
"You have said enough,"
he replied with a sudden composure, so unnatural and so ghastly that it tried my nerves as no outbreak of violence could have tried them. "I want one moment for my own thoughts, if you please. Do you guess what I'm thinking about?"
"Perhaps I do."
"I am thinking," he remarked quietly, "whether I shall add to the disorder in this room by scattering your brains about the fireplace." If I had moved at that moment, I saw in his face that he would have done it. "I advise you to read two lines of writing which I have about me," I rejoined, "before you finally decide that question." The proposal appeared to excite his curiosity. He nodded his head. I took Pesca's acknowledgement of the receipt of my letter out of my pocketbook, handed it to him at arm's length, and returned to my former position in front of the fireplace. He read the lines aloud. "Your letter is received. If I don't hear from you before the time you mention, I will break the seal when the clock strikes." Another man in his position would have needed some explanation of those words. The Count felt no such necessity. One reading of the note showed him the precaution that I had taken as plainly as if he had been present at the time when I adopted it. The expression of his face changed on the instant, and his hand came out of the drawer, empty. "I don't lock up my drawer, Mr. Hartwright," he said, "and I don't say that I may not scatter your brains about the fireplace yet. But I am a just man, even to my enemy, and I will acknowledge beforehand that they are cleverer brains than I thought them. Come to the point, sir. You want something of me."
"I do, and I mean to have it."
"On conditions?"
"On no conditions."
His hand dropped into the drawer again.
"Bah! We are travelling in a circle," he said, "and those clever brains of yours are in danger again. Your tone is deplorably imprudent, sir. Moderate it on the spot. The risk of shooting you on the place where you stand is less to me than the risk of letting you out of this house, except on conditions that I dictate and approve. You have not got my lamented friend to deal with now. You are face to face with Fosco. If the lives of 20 Mr. Hartwrights were the stepping stones to my safety, over all those stones I would go, sustained by my sublime indifference, self-balanced by my impenetrable calm. Respect me if you love your own life. I summon you to answer 3 questions before you open your lips again. Hear them. They are necessary to this interview. Answer them. They are necessary to me."
He held up one finger of his right hand. "First question," he said. "You come here possessed of information which may be true or may be false. Where did you get it?"
"I decline to tell you."
"No matter. I shall find out. If that information is true, mind, I say with the whole force of my resolution, if you are making your market of it here by treachery of your own or by treachery of some other man, I note that circumstance for future use in my memory which forgets nothing, and proceed." He held up another finger. "Second question. Those lines you invited me to read are without signature. Who wrote them?" "A man whom I have every reason to depend on, and whom you have every reason to fear." My answer reached him to some purpose. His left hand trembled audibly in the drawer.
"How long do you give me?"
he asked, putting his third question in a quieter tone.
"Before the clock strikes and the seal is broken."
"Time enough for you to come to my terms," I replied.
Give me a plainer answer, Mr. Hartwright. What hour is the clock to strike?
9 tomorrow morning.
9 tomorrow morning. Yes, yes. Your trap is laid for me before I can get my passport regulated and leave London. It is not earlier, I suppose. We will see about that presently. I can keep you hostage here and bargain with you to send for your letter before I let you go. In the meantime, be so good next as to mention your terms. You shall hear them. They are simple and soon stated. You know whose interests I represent in coming here. He smiled with the most supreme composure and carelessly waved his right hand. I consent to hazard a guess, he said jeeringly. A lady's interests, of course. My wife's interests. He looked at me with the first honest expression that had crossed his face in my presence. An expression of blank amazement. I could see that I sank in his estimation as a dangerous man from that moment. He shut up the drawer at once, folded his arms over his breast, and listened to me with a smile of satirical attention. You are well enough aware, I went on, of the course which my inquiries have taken for many months past, to know that any attempted denial of plain facts will be quite useless in my presence. You are guilty of an infamous conspiracy, and the gain of a fortune of £10,000 was your motive for it. He said nothing, but his face became overclouded suddenly by a lowering anxiety. Keep your gain, I said. His face lightened again immediately, and his eyes opened on me in wider and wider astonishment. I am not here to disgrace myself by bargaining for money which has passed through your hands and which has been the price of a vile crime. Gently, Mr. Hartwright. Your moral claptraps have an excellent effect in England. Keep them for yourself and your own countrymen, if you please. The £10,000 was a legacy left to my excellent wife by the late Mr. Fairley. Place the affair on those grounds, and I will discuss it if you like. To a man of my sentiments, however, the subject is deplorably sordid. I prefer to pass it over. I invite you to resume the discussion of your terms. What do you demand? In the first place, I demand a full confession of the conspiracy, written and signed in my presence by yourself. He raised his finger again. One, he said, checking me off with the steady attention of a practical man. In the second place, I demand a plain proof, which does not depend on your personal asseveration, of the date at which my wife left Blackwater Park and travelled to London. So, you can lay your finger, I see, on the weak place, he remarked composedly. Any more? At present, no more. Good. You have mentioned your terms. Now listen to mine. The responsibility to myself of admitting what you are pleased to call the conspiracy is less, perhaps, upon the whole, than the responsibility of laying you dead on that hearthrug. Let us say that I meet your proposal on my own conditions. The statement you demand of me shall be written, and the plain proof shall be produced. You call a letter from my late lamented friend informing me of the day and hour of his wife's arrival in London, written, signed, and dated by himself, a proof, I suppose. I can give you this. I can also send you to the man of whom I hired the carriage to fetch my visitor from the railway on the day when she arrived. His order book may help you to your date, even if his coachman, who drove me, proves to be of no use. These things I can do and will do, on conditions. I recite them. First condition. Madame Fosco and I leave this house, when and how we please, without interference of any kind on your part. Second condition. You wait here, in company with me, to see my agent, who is coming at 7 o'clock in the morning to regulate my affairs. You give my agent a written order to the man who has got your sealed letter to resign his possession of it. You wait here till my agent places that letter unopened in my hands, and you then allow me one clear half hour to leave the house, after which you resume your own freedom of action and go where you please. Third condition, you give me the satisfaction of a gentleman for your intrusion into my private affairs, and for the language you have allowed yourself to use to me at this conference. The time and place, abroad, to be fixed in a letter from my hand when I am safe on the continent, and that letter to contain a strip of paper measuring accurately the length of my sword. Those are my terms. Inform me if you accept them, yes or no. The extraordinary mixture of prompt decision, far-sighted cunning, and mountebank bravado in this speech staggered me for a moment, and only for a moment. The one question to consider was whether I was justified or not in possessing myself of the means of establishing Laura's identity at the cost of allowing the scoundrel who had robbed her of it to escape me with impunity. I knew that the motive of securing the just recognition of my wife in the birthplace from which she had been driven out as an impostor, and of publicly erasing the lie that still profaned her mother's tombstone, was far purer in its freedom from all taint of evil passion than the vindictive motive which had mingled itself with my purpose from the first. And yet, I cannot honestly say that my own moral convictions were strong enough to decide the struggle in me by themselves. They were helped by my remembrance of Sir Percival's death. How awfully, at the last moment, had the working of the retribution there been snatched from my feeble hands. What right had I to decide, in my poor mortal ignorance of the future, that this man, too, must escape with impunity, because he escaped me? I thought of these things, perhaps with the superstition inherent in my nature, perhaps with a sense worthier of me than superstition. It was hard, when I had fastened my hold on him at last, to loosen it again of my own accord, but I forced myself to make the sacrifice. In plainer words, I determined to be guided by the one higher motive of which I was certain, the motive of serving the cause of Laura and the cause of truth. "I accept your conditions," I said, "with one reservation on my part."
"What reservation may that be?" he asked.
"It refers to the sealed letter," I answered. "I require you to destroy it, unopened, in my presence as soon as it is placed in your hands." My object in making this stipulation was simply to prevent him from carrying away written evidence of the nature of my communication with Pesca. The fact of my communication he would necessarily discover when I gave the address to his agent in the morning. But he could make no use of it on his own unsupported testimony, even if he really ventured to try the experiment, which need excite in me the slightest apprehension on Pesca's account. "I grant your reservation," he replied, after considering the question gravely for a minute or two. "It is not worth dispute. The letter shall be destroyed when it comes into my hands." He rose as he spoke from the chair in which he had been sitting opposite to me up to this time. With one effort he appeared to free his mind from the whole pressure on it of the interview between us thus far.
"Oof!" he cried, stretching his arms luxuriously. "The skirmish was hot while it lasted. Take a seat, Mr. Hartwright. We meet as mortal enemies hereafter. Let us, like gallant gentlemen, exchange polite attentions in the meantime. Permit me to take the liberty of calling for my wife."
He unlocked and opened the door. "Eleanor," he called out in his deep voice. The lady of the viperish face came in. "Madame Fosco, Mr. Hartwright," said the Count, introducing us with easy dignity. "My angel," he went on, addressing his wife, "will your labours of packing up allow you time to make me some nice strong coffee? I have writing business to transact with Mr. Hartwright, and I require the full possession of my intelligence to do justice to myself." Madame Fosco bowed her head twice, once sternly to me, once submissively to her husband, and glided out of the room. The Count walked to a writing table near the window, opened his desk, and took from it several quires of paper and a bundle of quill pens. He scattered the pens about the table so that they might lie ready in all directions to be taken up when wanted,
and then cut the paper into a heap of narrow slips of the form used by professional writers for the press.
"I shall make this a remarkable document," he said, looking at me over his shoulder. "Habits of literary composition are perfectly familiar to me. One of the rarest of all the intellectual accomplishments that a man can possess is the grand faculty of arranging his ideas. Immense privilege. I possess it. Do you?"